Welcome to the Global Marketing Show, the podcast for all things international business. I'm your host, Wendy Pease, president of Rapport International and a translation expert. Come along with me today as we talk to an expert in the global marketing world about facing their biggest fears, hearing about mistakes they made or saw, discussing best practices, and sharing fun travel language and culture stories. Hi, welcome to this edition of the Global Marketing Podcast. I'm very, very excited for today's discussion because I have Ed Marsh on with me, who I've known for years, and he's a really, really smart guy. So hi, Ed, welcome.
Hey, Wendy, thanks very much for having me.
Oh, I'm excited. I think this is going to be a good conversation. So a little bit about Ed. He is the Chief Revenue Officer for Intent Data. He's founder and principal of Consilium Business Advisors. He's a frequent keynote speaker, particularly to senior executive teams for B2B companies about international growth. He's a member of the Committee for New Hampshire Nonprofit, dedicating to helping the visually impaired and their families. I didn't know that. He's on the advisory board for Brandeis University. And he's got a BA in history and economics for Johns Hopkins. And I'm realizing there's nothing in here about your military background, too. So he's a vet and he's traveled the world. So welcome.
Thanks very much for that kind introduction.
All right. Well, let's jump right into it, because with a lot of guests, or when I speak on podcasts, I just ban Google Translate and the Google plugin. You have a different position on it.
So yeah, this is something we've gone back and forth on this for years. So you know, we've both honed our arguments or our positions on it. We'll see where we end up today.
Okay. All right. So Google Translate, that's when, excuse me, you go into Google, you type in Google Translate, you copy and paste the words in there, and then it gives it to you in the other language. Where do you think that's appropriate to use?
The only place I use that is if I'm at the grocery store, you know, an ethnic grocery store, and I'm trying to read a label. That's the only place I use that.
Okay. Okay. So you don't recommend that anybody using that in their marketing?
Well, if you were trying to read a foreign newspaper or something and you wanted to try to figure out a phrase, that's great. In their marketing, I would absolutely not recommend anybody use that anywhere in their international marketing.
Okay, so what about the Google Translate plugin? That's where a web developer will take the plugin, put it on a website, and then it'll automatically, through machine translation and AI, translate the whole website so you can read it. Now, I scream about people using this. I say, don't do it. It makes you look really bad. Where would you say that that's okay to use it?
So, see, that's where we disagree. Now, I believe the way a company goes international, I mean, it used to be people would come up with a big plan. They'd say, we got to go to China. They'd spend 7 years and dump millions of dollars there and have nothing to show for it. They've got a different way to proceed now. What they can do is do really good digital marketing for their domestic audience. You know, U.S. companies have the benefit of doing it in American English, which is fairly broadly searched and read and understood. And so if they do great digital marketing for their U.S. market, guess what? Lo and behold, international buyers, international prospects are going to stumble on them and come to their website. So that's the huge opportunity that people have today. Now, if somebody comes from Australia, although they may notice the difference between OR and OUR, they're going to have no problem reading the website. There will be some cultural issues with it. The job titles, for instance, we may talk about the president, they may talk about the managing director. So it's, you know, it's not a perfect cultural analog. It would need proper kind of social transcreation if you wanted to have an Australian website, but people will certainly get the gist of it. They'll understand the message. On the other hand, if somebody comes from Indonesia, or you know, Brazil or Turkey or Poland, and may not have that facility and familiarity with English, they may be able to read some in English enough to get the gist of it, but wouldn't they prefer to have a slightly easier experience? So if you don't know where you're going in the world, if what you're doing is marketing to American companies, and lo and behold, some international companies start to stumble into you, the Google widget gives you the ability to provide an experience for them that's a little bit friendlier, a little bit easier, at no cost. And the beauty of it is they know that they're getting Google's translation. They're not left with the impression that you somehow tried to really craft your message in their native language and made it so incredibly silly that it's nonsensical. If it's nonsensical, they'll know that Google made it nonsensical. They're not going to hold you responsible for that. And in fact, they'll appreciate the fact that you've made it more accessible for them. Now, you know, where I think we can probably go with this conversation is, what's the next step? If you see you're getting a bunch of traffic from Poland, you're getting a lot of interest, people are using that Google Translate widget, they're getting some familiarity in their native language because of the widget, then you may decide, as you start to get a couple deals done, that maybe it makes sense to create a landing page in Polish. Maybe you do some SEO in Polish. Maybe you understand what the key terms are and research the buyer persona, which will likely be different, and build that in Polish. And then maybe you create a microsite. But you don't do that with Google Translate. You do that with a professional services firm that understands marketing, understands digital, understands foreign languages, can transcreate culturally, et cetera.
Okay. Well, this is interesting because I think we've had a very, very different opinion, but we're actually landing this year more the same. Like I could never go so far as to say, put it on there, but I can see what you're saying with the translate into a good language once you've decided to go in there, but for the rest of the languages, put it in there because you're not doing it yet, and then you can gather some information.
And again, I mean, the critical point is anybody that uses it will appreciate the convenience, but anything silly about it, they're going to hold Google responsible for. They're not going to think that somehow it's a poor reflection on you. It's going to be, well, Google's not perfect, but at least I know what they're saying.
Right, right. And that's where I have tons of examples where people have gone into websites and they've got really bad things that they don't even understand. And so that's right. What they're coming to us saying, okay, now we need the high quality.
Right.
Okay.
But then there's a whole nother piece of it. I mean, the translation of the language is one thing, but people buy differently. Different roles buy differently. Companies have different processes for research and approval for budgets and all of the cultural stuff that also really fits into translation, but often is overlooked when people think it's just a matter of converting word for word.
Yes, yeah, so you had used a word I hadn't heard before. You called it social transcreation.
I just made it up. I mean, what it's doing is piggybacking the fact that there's sociological differences reflected in business and culture, et cetera, and there's a language difference. And so you mash the two up and you have to account for both of them.
Okay. So we've called that cultural adaptation.
Fine.
Okay. But I like that social transcreation because it's more than just the words. I was talking to somebody on an earlier podcast who was talking about the difference in marketing in Finland. And he was saying there, people want the features and the stats. Whereas you come to the US, you have to tell a story and talk benefits.
Right.
And so that's a real difference that you need to do. All right. So tell me about some of the companies tell me about what you do with Consilium Global Advisors and Intent Data and some of the companies that you've worked with, maybe getting into, you know, when they make the decision to go, problems that you've seen. Let's start there.
All right. So two very different businesses. IntentData.io is in the intent data space, as the name implies. And that's for folks that aren't familiar with intent data, essentially what it does is your website will often have tools on it to help you understand what people are doing on your website, which you can use to gauge intent and interest and activity. But there's often no analog for what happens everywhere else on the internet. And so third-party intent data helps people understand what's happening with competitors and with general information. And so it can be used to identify those companies that may actually be in market. It's said that only 3% of the potential buyers for any given product or service are actually in market at any given time. And so how do you know those 3%? So you're not wasting, as the expression says, I know I'm wasting half my marketing, I just don't know which half. Well, I mean, intent data helps you figure out where to focus. So that's one business. The other business is a consulting business. And in that business, I work primarily with middle market industrial manufacturers, often capital equipment companies. And So that's an interesting process because there's a lot of work that has to be done in order to kind of shift the mindset from a very traditional trade show focused, a sales brochure sort of a process to a digital mindset to accommodate the way buyers are buying now. That is the first step. And what's interesting is that in many cases, those companies have robust international business through trade shows that they've been to for years. And they've got very long, well-established, often privately held, family-owned businesses that have distributors and agents around the world that have helped them grow. In other cases, they've never worried about it and they don't have international business. What I used to do was talk to companies about exporting. Let's get you started. Let's help you find international markets. Let's go about the process. And I found that companies just weren't interested. I mean, they were busy focusing on what they were working on. And so the convergence of digital and kind of growing international trade worked out well, because what we're able to do is help a company do the right things for their domestic market, in other words, the U.S. market, build the right kind of digital presence they need to have. And then, as I mentioned earlier, lo and behold, guess what? I mean, suddenly somebody comes from Indonesia. Somebody comes from Turkey. Somebody comes from Saudi Arabia looking for the stuff, and they gradually understand where there's interest, where there's demand, where they're able to get deals done, where they have satisfied customers, where they can find strong reps and distributors. And so the international growth happens organically as opposed to kind of based on some sort of a strategic plan.
Okay, right. So your background is being a HubSpot partner and understanding marketing and the strategy all in that area. And now you've married it up with your international experience and you can help these companies.
Right.
Right. Okay. And so how are they getting it? Are they going? So they're exporting, but they're not thinking they're exporting. They're just selling online. So it's now global internet selling.
Well, so I mean, most of this is capital equipment or fairly large sales. And so they'll develop the prospect. They'll begin the communication kind of through the website and online, but the transaction is not an e-commerce transaction. Right. They have to take it offline to do the financial piece, to do the logistics piece and all of that. But what's interesting is often I'll say to people, all right, buckle up. You know, we're focused on the US, but in about a year, you're going to sell your first international deal because of leads that you got from your website. Oh, yeah. We'll see if that happens. And I mean, a great example is a longtime client of mine in Nashville that does durable goods, who had never sold internationally and has now sold, I think, to South Korea, to Bulgaria, to a Latin American country. They sold to several places, and it's happened organically because people have found them. They went to the Department of Commerce, the UCAC, the U.S. Export Assistance Center, for tips on handling payment and on handling logistics. They found a freight forwarder, and they got the deal done. So the interest developed. They negotiated the deal. They used some of those resources that are available that we often talk about that people can turn to help get those technical questions answered that they have. And so now they're an exporter.
Okay. And so what country did you say they were from?
My client is in Nashville, but I think they've sold to South Korea, to, I think it was Bulgaria, and I think somewhere in Latin America, if I remember correctly, in addition to several to Australia and New Zealand.
Okay. So the request coming in English? Mm-hmm. And so they're doing the whole deal in English?
They are. And what's interesting, there's some countries like Brazil, for instance, where if you travel to Brazil to do business, if you can't speak Portuguese, you better have a Portuguese interpreter with you, because you just can't do business in person in English. On the other hand, I've found that many Brazilian companies are very comfortable downloading American English content, you know, PDFs, guides, that sort of thing, and consuming that, because they can kind of do it at their own pace, and they're comfortable reading the language. They're just not as comfortable speaking and communicating in the language.
Right. Well, and it's interesting because all the statistics about people online, like they can read and they can read slower and process it. Mm-hmm. But the statistics show that 90% of the people prefer to read language in their own. 70%, over 70% will spend more time, and 50% are apt to spend more money on a purchase if it's in their own language.
Right.
So that's why it's almost surprising to me that this company has had such, you know, is doing it in English. Now, do you ever guide them to start doing translation, or these are big, big sales that one sale makes their year, or they don't need to do the translation, or there's not much more in the market? You know,
so
what I mean?
In that case with that client, it's really been, it's been a kind of a nice bonus for them. It's not their focus. If they can sell those deals profitably, they're happy to do it, but it's not where they're seeking to grow. And so we never talked about translation or developing landing pages or microsites or some of those incremental steps that people can take to expand internationally on a digital platform while mitigating the risk. And on the other hand, in other cases where people say, wow, we never knew that, you know, Turkey would be such a fruitful market for us, for instance. And you know, just one kind of comment on markets. China and India are the places that people assume they need to go. And many years ago when I started my company in India, I did it primarily because most people were going to China. And, you know, I had to be in a big market. And so that's how I picked India. I think that if you look geopolitically, India over the course of the next 10 years is probably going to be a much more fruitful market for Americans in terms of collaboration and cooperation. But nevertheless, there's nothing that says you have to go to a billion plus person market. If you find that Vietnam with 80 million people, which you can basically handle with, you know, a distributor in Hanoi and a distributor in Saigon, or, you know, two of your own offices or something, 80 million people is, what is that, 30% of the size of the U.S. Now, maybe the purchasing power equivalence isn't there, but you can grow your sales substantially in very reasonably sized, manageable markets like Colombia, like Vietnam, like, you know, some of the Poland, some of those countries that are growing quickly in Eastern Europe. So anyway, if in the case where companies find substantial pockets of interest, lots, first they see the traffic, then they see the inquiries, then they see the deals in the pipeline, then they see what closes, then they see where those deals work out well, you know, without conflict, without payment issues, without logistics problems, all the kinds of stuff that can be frustrating, then they can say to themselves, okay, really interesting. We had no idea. That's not the market we would have thought to start with. We had no idea there was that demand there, but what we found is that there is demand. We're able to do deals profitably and satisfactorily. It's fruitful business for us. So let's figure out how we can build a more concrete presence focused on whatever that market may be.
I think that's excellent advice. So often I hear about companies that want to go into English speaking markets because they don't want to deal with the language issues, but then they're competing with everybody that's going into the UK and Australia and Hong Kong and Canada, and you pick another country like that, you might have less competition and a smoother operating schedule. I think that's excellent advice. Yeah, so talk about, you listed a bunch of the problems. Tell me about some of the problems that people typically run into.
Well, they're the same ones. Anytime you talk to somebody about exporting, you get the deer in the headlight look, and you get the, oh, but what about foreign currency, risk, logistics, legal and corruption. I mean, those are the things that people rightly worry about. They often exaggerate or worry too much about them. And there are technical experts that can help you easily mitigate risks and handle all those issues. You know, I try to use an example for people. If you try to run your own payroll, if you've got 20 or 30 people in your company, you try to run your own payroll, that's a real pain in the neck. It's complicated. You're going to mess up the filings and the reports and all that kind of stuff. And so you outsource it to somebody. Well, guess what? Handling international logistics is exactly the same kind of a thing. It's tremendously complex, but there's people that do that and it's transparent for you. And so you pay them to do it. You hand it off to them and you solve the problem for yourself that way. That's what they're supposed to do. That's their job.
So how would people go about finding these experts?
So if you know folks that are selling internationally, you can certainly ask for referrals, but the U.S. Export Assistance Center, the USEAC, which is the office of the Department of Commerce that's in most major U.S. cities, has people that are there to coach you and advise you, often at no charge, on how to get these kinds of transactions done. Their job is to help American companies sell more internationally.
Yes, yes, that's so true. And okay, so the number one, so solutions and suggestions would be to, you know, find good experts. What are some other pieces of advice that you'd offer to people who want to sell internationally?
Don't assume that you have to sell cheap. You know, people often assume that international buyers are more price sensitive, and that's not necessarily the case. Don't assume that the purchasing process, whether it's the buying team or the tempo of the transaction or the criteria for selection, are going to be the same. The commercial experience can be very, very different. You know, a good example, my consulting clients that sell capital equipment often to large food manufacturers, for instance, will often work with a plant engineer, a plant manager, a plant maintenance person, maybe a corporate engineer, and somebody from procurement. This is kind of typically what the buying team might look like. And a project might well be started by a plant engineer who could be a 25 or a 30-year-old, recently minted, very capable and very creative and energetic, but relatively young and inexperienced engineer that might have an idea. On the other hand, you go into certain other markets where it's got to come from the silverback, the guy that started the company that controls everything very tightly. And, so it's a very different sort of an environment. It may be one person making the decision as opposed to a team making the decision. Maybe it's a decision that requires you building a friendship for 18 months first before you even really talk about business, as opposed to our very transactional sort of an environment here. So people need to understand that the process of doing business will be different in a number of ways.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's excellent advice. And talk to me about where you've done business and some cultural differences that you have run into and how you would handle going into a new culture.
So culture is fascinating, and it's amazing how it can trip you up. So I started and ran a company in India, and I was in India very frequently for a number of years. And I remember one time, after several years of experience there, I was sitting in a meeting with somebody where the guy who ran my office there was basically translating English between the MD of this company we were meeting with and myself. We were both speaking English, but it was so different, neither of us could understand each other. And at one point I said something about how strong his accent was. And he said, no, you got it wrong. There's 300 million of you. There's a billion of us. You're the one with the accent.
You got the accent.
And, you know, he was right, as I thought about it. So, another example or another story I tell people is I've been married to a German national for about 10 years and became partners with a German company. And in the space of about a year of working with the German company, I realized there were certain things that happened in discussion, you know, that potentially lead to arguments or whatever the case may be, that tended to actually be cultural, which I had not appreciated prior to that. And so, you know, I kind of learned some lessons for my marriage from having been partners with the German company.
Like what kind of cultural differences could cause that tension? What were you saying with Germans?
Just certain kinds of expressions and ways of saying things that would be interpreted in different sorts of ways, where, you know, suddenly people would get their hackles up and you realize in retrospect that wasn't what was intended. But the translation of German into English and whatever the kind of the original phrase or thought was didn't translate well. And so it ended up provoking reactions that were not, you know, kind of what was intended.
Well, I'm glad to hear that can happen across languages with you. That can happen in just English with me. Like my intention is pure and kind and helpful, and it's taken a different way. So,
of course, that's exactly the point, that a lot of what people wrestle with that they attribute to international business is just a matter of people being people. And, you know, trying to figure out how to work together and how to get along and how to exchange, communicate and deliver information. And then you lay on top of that. So that's already difficult, as we all know. Then you lay on top language, which doesn't translate directly, and culture and time zones and fatigue and everything else on top of it. And it's very different.
Yeah. So tell me one of the biggest cultural mistakes that you've seen happen, either somebody coming into the U.S. or you going into the country or somebody else. Has it ever blown a deal or caused a problem?
So rather than talk about acutely kind of embarrassing events that I've witnessed, what I'll talk more about is the difference. I know the dynamic between Germany and the U.S. quite well. Mm-hmm. And in the machine building world and in the companies that support machines and that sort of thing, it's a place I've spent a lot of time and have some pretty good familiarity. And one of the biggest struggles that I find is that if you look at how many times a German engineer, many times a German company will buy something based on the process the engineer goes through, which is very much driven by, they decide what they need, then they compare specs, and then they make a selection. So it's a very technically driven process against a very clearly defined objective. Whereas in the US, it's often much more, well, here's the outcome we need to try to get to. How can we get there? And what's the solution look like? And okay, well, so if that's the way we're going to do it, then what are the technical things we need to think about? And so, you know, we talk about budgetary or ballpark pricing, and they talk often about very precise pricing based on very precise specifications well in advance. And so when you contrast those two, what you find is that the way German companies often try to sell in the US assumes that US buyers will operate the same way. And it can be very, very frustrating for US buyers that are trying to find out about the feasibility of something, as opposed to, you know, I don't know yet how many millimeters, you know, that piece is going to be. We haven't done that yet. We haven't decided that yet. Just tell me, can I do this? And you end up with a very strong cultural conflict as a result.
Because you're really speaking a completely different language, not only German English, but technical.
Because business is done differently. You're approaching the question from completely different angles.
Okay, so pretend that you're going into a country. Where's a country you haven't been to yet? I knew this would be a stumper because you're well-traveled.
Bulgaria.
Okay, so you're going into Bulgaria. You know that there's a big cultural language difference there. How do you make yourself sensitive to you so you avoid any of the mistakes or struggles that can come up?
I don't think you avoid them. I mean, the reality is, as you said, no matter how hard you try to avoid it, talking to people here, it still happens sometimes. So you accept the fact that it's going to happen. I think you try to research the market a little bit. Maybe you go to a trade show as part of a U.S. pavilion, or maybe you get the Gold Key service and have somebody take you around for a while and kind of give you some of that situational awareness and sensitivity to things to be aware of. But I think that you also, you know, you're polite and you're respectful and you ask questions. Say, you know, I can't think of a good example quickly off the top of my head, but if you're observant about what people are doing around you, then you can kind of take your cues from what's going on and modulate or adapt what you're doing accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's, you hit a lot of key points there, is being observant and asking questions and leading. You know, oftentimes I'll hear people say, oh, the interpreter was an invaluable resource for asking about cultural questions, not just facilitating the language. So I think that's right. Accept that there's going to be some problems and then be polite and lean on your experts.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So some fun questions for you. Favorite vacation?
Oh, probably a house that we rented in Ibiza and sitting up on the roof overlooking the Mediterranean at 2 a.m, drinking cognac and having fun with our kids and their wives and girlfriends.
Oh, that's great. It sounds fairly recent.
That was probably 5 years ago.
5 years ago. Yeah. Your favorite memory of a rewarding cross-cultural experience?
When I was a kid, probably, I don't know, 10 or something like that, my family sponsored a Vietnamese refugee family. And so I kind of grew up with, I mean, they lived with us for some months, and then we were quite close physically and as families for a number of years, and still are in touch. And so I would say that, because it's been, you know, it's been a very kind of long-term experience.
Wow, that's fantastic, particularly right now when there's so many refugees in the world, to think that your parents took a family in. That's really admirable and rewarding too. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Favorite place to do business?
I've kind of gotten to like being in my office and not going to the airport. That's been the upside of the pandemic. So I would say my favorite place to do business is right where I am right now.
That's great. Craziest travel story.
I remember I was supposed to go to Sacramento for about a 4-hour meeting. I was going to fly in the night before, have dinner with the people, have a meeting the next morning, and fly back out the next afternoon. I ended up getting in at about 4 in the morning and had the meeting, and then took the red eye back to Boston the next night. So that was an unpleasant couple of days.
Oh, God, that sounds awful. Yeah. Good thing a little sleep will solve that one, but still. Yep. Yeah. What about recommendations for resources or how people go about thinking about international business or learning more?
I think, well, obviously the USIAC is a great resource, and many states have programs as well. They all tend to be kind of canned and vanilla, and everyone has slightly different questions and perspectives on what they're trying to do. I would say that the biggest thing is the change that's happened over the last 10 years, where people don't have to decide to go international, throw money at it, guess at a market, speculate on the whole thing, and hope that it's right, and then debate whether they continue to chase their sunk costs or not. But rather, what they can do is follow this very incremental path and let the market show them where the opportunities are. And so it substantially reduces the risk of resources, not only money, but time traveling back and forth and all kinds of other stuff. They can identify where the traffic, the inquiries, the opportunities, the done deals, and those, and the happy customers are coming from, and then decide if there's markets that they ought to try to proactively enter.
Yeah, I think that's really, I mean, that's been a dramatic change in the last 10 years and just over the year of the pandemic. What do you think that's going to, go ahead.
I was going to say, people, I think of that as a resource. You know, it's not a book that you read, it's not a video that you watch, but the fact that you can now let the market guide you is a huge resource that was never available before.
Right, right. So many other cultures or countries, you have to really build a relationship with somebody before you do business with them. Here in the United States, we want to do business and then maybe a relationship will grow. What are you seeing now, you know, in 2020 with how relationships are changing and building online so people still can do international business?
I don't really have a good sense of that. I mean, I would say that if somebody's reaching out to you online, they're more transactional in their perspective because they're thinking about something. On the other hand, if you say, I really want to go build a business in Argentina, and you accept the fact that you're going to have to travel back and forth for 2 years and develop relationships and create friendships, and then eventually maybe you can get that business piece going, it's a kind of a different sort of a dynamic. So if somebody's contacting you, there, by definition, it means there's some kind of interest in some sort of a transaction as opposed to you cultivating a relationship that you hope will eventually lead to business.
Right, right. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out over the longer term. Now, also, word on the street is that, you know, oh, we should source from the US and going global is dangerous and there's been trade restrictions and all that. But I did hear a trade advisor that was really talking and saying the dollar's getting stronger and it's an ideal time and you have the internet. What are you seeing with your clients and in the market going? Is this a good time to do international business?
So I think it's different than it was 5 years ago. 5 years ago, kind of, it was the baseline expectation for many countries. I mean, not so much for American companies, but many countries just expected it. The dollar, it's strengthened a little bit the last couple of days, but generally for most of this year, the dollar has been weakening since about the middle of March. And it seems that most people think that's going to continue. So that certainly helps companies export. Because a weaker dollar makes our products less expensive for international buyers. So that probably helps from that angle. I think that there's certainly countries where tensions and perceptions of the U.S. and likelihood of trade problems are higher, and those may be a little bit more problematic. There's less talk, my sense is, about FCPA, and it certainly doesn't mean that it's a free license for American companies to engage in corrupt practices, but it seems like that's not as high a priority right now for the government. So, you know, I think that companies that are trying to sell into markets that may be a little bit trickier may have a little bit easier time. Again, not to endorse or condone inappropriate or illegal activity, but they may not feel that there may be more latitude in how what would normally be considered normal business is interpreted. And I don't have concrete examples for that. I'm just speculating about that.
Okay. So it's not a better or worse time. There's just a change going on.
That's true. But again, what you can do is follow the market. I mean, if you're doing your stuff right digitally, then you're going to figure out where the opportunities are. And if somebody you're not going to get a lot of inquiries from Venezuela. So you're not going to, you know, commit to a market where you can't sell and you shouldn't be doing business. But maybe Croatia, which is kind of quasi EU in some ways, clearly it's in the EU, but it's kind of a different sort of an orbit there. Maybe there's something unique about the economy where it's stronger and they're doing well. And you start getting inquiries and so you say, okay, you know, we hadn't thought of it, but let's focus on that for a while.
I would love to go to Croatia. I've heard marvelous things about that. And I've been looking at pictures come up on my computer from there. So is that one of the countries you've been to?
I have, yes.
You have? As great as I've heard?
Yeah, it's very pretty. I was there for about a week, and it was mostly just kind of in one place in a, not an Airbnb, but a kind of the German travel equivalent of that. Stayed in a place there, and it was a nice time.
Ah, that's excellent. All right, you have any last words or thoughts?
So have we reached an accommodation on the translate widget?
Okay, so I want to bring this one up too, because this is the other problem that I've seen is people will put the widget at the very bottom of their site so visitors can't find it. And then when you do the language drop down, the languages aren't translated. So if I were to go to a Chinese site, I'd have to know the Chinese characters for English to even get to it. Is that what you're seeing?
I honestly haven't paid attention to that. I'm not aware of that ever having been a problem. And actually, I've noticed lately Chrome will have a little pop-out
that
says it's in this language. Do you want it in your language? I don't know if that's based on language tags or if they're figuring it out themselves or what.
Yeah. It's got to be language tags, or it's got to be looking at your IP from where it's coming in from and identifying, you know, preferred language.
Right.
But yeah, so I'm not fully as sold to pop it on to every site because I still think there's problems. But I understand if you've got a limited budget and you put it on there and make it accessible, that people might be able to read it. I just also look at the potential liability. I think a suit's going to come out because a lot of the states are putting the widget in there now. And I think that somebody's going to miss some information and there's going to be a case, and then you're going to have to opt into it or something like that. There's going to have to be a disclaimer. But I understand more where you're coming from, that if you're not going to go for the expense of doing the quality translation, what the heck, pop it up and see if you get anything that comes in. But you better be watching the metrics, because if you want to maximize what your inbound is doing, then get a quality. So
exactly. We're absolutely,
yeah, much closer than we've been in before.
Good. Terrific. Well, in a world that seems to be drifting further apart, it's nice to find consensus on something.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, where can people find you if they want to learn more?
So they can learn about my consulting business at consiliumglobalbusinessadvisors.com. That's C-O-N-S-I-L-I-U-M, globalbusinessadvisors.com. They can learn about Intent Data at intentdata.io.
Okay. And are you very active on LinkedIn?
I am on LinkedIn, yes.
Okay.
If they search Ed Marsh, I think they'll find me. There's a couple of us, but... I think I don't honestly remember what my handle is on LinkedIn.
But if they search Ed Marsh and either Consilium or Global
Absolutely.
Advisors, then you can find him, reach out and connect with him. He's a brilliant mind in global marketing, global trade. He's been a speaker at Inbound, which is the HubSpot huge inbound marketing conference that is in September every year. So Ed, I really appreciate you being on here today. It was great talking to you.
Well, my pleasure, Wendy. Thanks very much for having me on.
Okay. And if you learned something today, then please share the podcast with somebody else. And remember, you can find it to listen to and all your favorite places to listen to podcasts. We'll see you next time.
That's a wrap for this session. A big thanks to you for listening to the Global Marketing Show. Hope you had just as much fun as I did. New sessions launch weekly on all places you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, YouTube, and of course on our website. If you know someone interested in this topic, please tell them about us. Au revoir for now.